boy. Swing it, brother, swing. Don't stop to diddle-daddle. Stop this foolish prattle. Come on, swing the gate. Swing it, brother, swing. Ready to go. And there ain't nobody gonna hold me down. Say, listen, Bo, hurry up and send me, let me go to town. Stop this diddle-daddle and this foolish prattle. Come on, kill me, Joe. Swing it, brother, swing. Deep rhythm captivates me. Hot rhythm stimulates me.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Wednesday edition. Today's date is September 26, 2007. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, it's wonderful to have you all listening into this broadcast, this most important of broadcasts. We try to find interesting and provocative topics and interviewees on the French Connection where we can kind of suss out the facts around this world conspiracy that we all know is real. And today I've brought on someone who's been on my show once before. We have been in communication many times on phone calls. Her name is Joan Vion. She is a researcher. She is a campaigner for women's issues, as well as a member of several important groups that have done research on the subjects we touch on. She's recently been at a meeting of the United Nations where she was privy to certain events that they're very interesting in how they were set up and what she's seen over the years, because she's been able to actually participate in many of these UN events. So I thought I'd bring her up and have her tell you in her own words some of these things that caught her attention. Joan, are you with me?
I am. Thank you, Daryl.
It's great to have you here with me. You know, last time we did a show, I think, was about over a year ago. You know, you just recently got back from that UN conference, and you had some interesting takes on it that actually it actually confirmed some takes you had over the last couple of meetings. Could you explain to the listeners what you've been witnessing, the changes you've been witnessing in this meeting, the meeting that's taken place?
Yes. Let me first preface with the fact that this was my 98th global meeting. I have been a freelance reporter. Nobody has sponsored me. Nobody has, you know, I'm not paid for by anybody. Nobody owns me. And I have covered 98 global meetings around the world, and I've just been all over the place. Starting in 1994 with my first environmental meeting, which was the United Nations Conference on Population and Development, where I heard the Calypso guy, Jacques Cousteau.
Jacques Cousteau,
basically tell the president of the World Bank, Lou Preston, who was formerly the president of the New York Federal Reserve, that, hey, Lou, I've done some studies on this population issue, and I figured out that we would have to eliminate 350,000 people a day. Don't you agree? Well, Lou Preston did not want to touch that with a 10-foot pole.
Well, so you know, that's an interesting thing, because everyone believes that Jacques Cousteau is revered here in France, and in fact, in many quarters, he's reviled. And that might come as a shock to Americans, because they watch so much of these documentaries on TV, but go ahead with your next part.
Well, so the conferences that I've covered over the years include United Nations conferences, environmental, economic, the Bank for International Settlements, the G7, the G8, the World Economic Forum, the IMF, the World Bank, World Trade. You know, I've just been the International Criminal Court, many, many different meetings. And I've gone to the United Nations many times for either UN General Assembly meetings or on Monday, the high-level leaders meeting on climate change. In March, I was in London at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, where I covered a 15-year overview on sustainable development. And what absolutely was shocking to me, I don't know what I expected. I sort of expected all the big kahunas who I've seen, who've been the leaders in the whole environmental movement, to be there and to talk about, well, you know, this is what happened, and this is what we saw, and this is how it evolved, and this is where we are. And instead, I was absolutely dumbfounded when the whole 2 or 3 days was given over to how you can make money on the environmental movement. And it was an expose on how different corporations, what they were doing to make money. Well, I can simply tell you in a few words or less, how they will make money is to squeeze us as turnips as they jack up the price of energy, electricity, water, as they start turning all the roads in America to toll roads where they will charge you 1 to 2 pennies for every tenth of a mile you drive on a toll road. And the list goes on. It's just so unbelievable. The idea, I interviewed a British MP, Challen Colin, or Colin Challen, I keep getting his name mixed up, who was very impressed with himself as he explained to me that what his proposal and his bill had not yet passed the parliament was to make every person give them a carbon allowance instead of a tax. He prefers the word allowance instead of tax. Give them a carbon allowance or an energy allowance so that if they exceed the amount of energy they are allotted, they will then have to buy energy rights from their neighbor or from the post office or from the government. And I even asked him, now all these, this is on my website, womensgroup.org. They can hear the actual interview. They can read the transcript. I mean, you know, I asked him, I said, did you get this idea from the Fabian Socialists? And he thought for a moment, and he said, no, not this one. And then when I was at the United Nations on Monday, it opened up with a plenary session of world leaders giving their little speech in the General Assembly. And Arnold Schwarzenegger was one of the initial public speakers, and all he could talk about is how California is leading the climate change efforts in the United States and worldwide, and how much money they will make and what they expect in the future.
Yeah.
And from there, that's all it was. And in fact, they had three other committee room discussions with world leaders giving their opinion and giving a speech. I mean, you know, in fact, Prince Albert was one of the co-chairs on one of the committee meetings. And the one committee meeting that I went into was with Gro Harlem Brundtland, who was the Prime Minister of Norway. She's a member of the Socialist International. I think she might have been vice president or president. And she headed up a group in the 1980s, 84, 85, called the Brundtland Commission, which basically helped coin the phrase sustainable development, which then Prince Charles commended her and her group for bringing the term sustainable development into all of our vocabularies.
Yeah.
And so she was there. And what was the bottom line? How much money you can make. How much money you can make from wind turbine, from solar energy, from solar cells, from all kinds of green things. The world is now green. I mean, if it wasn't green before, it's now going to be green. And at every turn are new innovative ways that will just tax you and me to death, literally, for every breath we take, for every moment we're awake, for every step we take. You know, in fact, let's see, Congressman or Senator, not Corzine, I'll get the name in a minute maybe. He's looking to write a bill and introduce a bill in which if you have a house here in America bigger than 3,000 square feet, and he estimates that there 15% of the homes in America are bigger than 15%. I think he's a little low on that figure, but in any event, then he wants to propose that they don't get to write off their mortgage interest deduction because their house is a real drain on the environment.
Well, let's talk a little bit about corporatization. And we discussed yesterday in a private call how we've been moving toward privatizing almost every function of government there is, including it used to be water systems were owned by the municipality. It used to be that trash pickup was owned by the municipality. It used to be that our electric areas in the United States, we would have a local power company that was owned by, oftentimes, by the people themselves. What we found out over the last 25 years is that each and every function of government is being turned over to companies to charge the American people, but also here in Europe. It's an identical situation here. And I'll give you an example, and this is one that's both in Europe and America. We've got a company called Veolia, and when I talked to you about Veolia yesterday, you were a little bit surprised, but they own 6 out of 10 major cities' water systems. And now Veolia is a French company principally held by Rothschild money. Now, this company right now in France is attempting to start the process of metering private wells. Mm-hmm. Now, as you know, any water under my land has always been considered my water. Mm-hmm. If a well was dug there and I put a bucket down, that was my water to take. Well, now Veolia has the right to come walking right on my property, check my my systems, check my water system, and I have to sign onto it because the government itself has given over abrogated its responsibility over to Veolia. That is not unique in France. It's happening in America as well. Now, what we do know is that along with this corporatization, when we talked yesterday about Pierpont Morgan being a front man for others, everyone thought he was a multi-millionaire. It turns out he had $14 million, I think, or $14 or $19 million on his deathbed. The fact is most of his money went back to old Europe. It went back to Rothschild. So how many proxy company chairmen and boards of directors are there right now out there fronting for Oppenheimer and for others? Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. What we're doing is we're turning over our military to corporations. We're turning over our prison systems to corporations. Even the schools now are being run by corporations. What is going on, Joan? Because you saw some evidence of this as well in some of these meetings, didn't you?
Well, absolutely. I have been tracking something called public-private partnership for 14 years.
Yep.
Oh, maybe 13 years. You know, it took me 6 months, you know, to understand. Well, actually, it was first this whole idea of bringing corporations in. When I go back to early United Nations documents, meaning 1992, 1994, they never, ever talked about the corporation. They never, ever talked about public-private partnership. They never used those words.
Right.
And when I interviewed somebody in 1997 about this, a key person, he said, well, he said there were subjects that were taboo at the United Nations. No one could discuss them, such as the role of the private sector, because of what was going on as a result of the Cold War, what was socialist, what was capitalist. And it just, you know, at that time wasn't acceptable. And so with the Habitat document in 1995 in Istanbul is when they started talking openly of public-private partnership. Furthermore, and I'll explain for people who don't know in a minute, furthermore, it was the first time, not that I was an expert at that time with the United Nations, but it was the first time that I had seen a parallel summit where corporations were present. And also at that conference, they had all kinds of workshops talking about oceans, about water, about cities, you know, every topic on Agenda 21 that you can think of.
Yep.
And I ended up writing my first book, Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince, because I realized he was leading a major effort to merge government, business, and non-governmental organizations into these public-private partnerships, which would be in a position then to switch, transfer, move, steal government assets and move them into a new organization called a public-private partnership in which that water facility or that power plant or whatever the people used to own through the government, whether it's local, county, state, federal, all of a sudden that asset was moved into this new entity, and there was a new board of directors with a new document covering what who had the rights, but of course whoever has the money has the rights.
That's right.
And there was this big transfer, and nobody was recognizing it, nor was anybody crying out, nor was anybody yelling about the fact that these assets were being switched out, and the people didn't even know these are the assets, the water system, the energy system, whatever the case may be, that their tax dollars had purchased, and all of a sudden they were being transferred into this new corporate entity.
And that's interesting because you make a very good point here, because no one here, especially here in France as well, and everybody thinks that this is a uniquely American phenomenon. What's happening here is European wide, and what we see here as well as in America is that all of these prior public held things are being transferred, but they haven't done anything about reducing our taxes. In fact, by and large, we're paying the same taxes, getting less services,
right,
and now we're having to pay the additional fee of these new private companies. And it astonishes me that people have sat by, Joan, and allowed this to happen right under their noses. It's been reported in the newspaper, but nobody has stood up and said, wait a minute, this doesn't smell right to me. And all of a sudden, now we're taking a look at it. When you talked about the sustainable prince, did you find connections from him to the banking empires out of London and different investment houses and corporations? Or what was his link to this? What was the motivation of this man? I mean, I know what he claims. What did you find when you were doing the research?
Well, it was very interesting because how I even connected Prince Charles was I was at a World Bank meeting where they were having a bunch of workshops, and I didn't know which one to go to because there were so many and I didn't quite understand a lot of the hidden terminology at the time. And as I was coming out of one, apparently next door was one on public-private partnership, which I wouldn't have understood. And as I was coming out the door, I saw a navy blue brochure out of the corner of my eye. And since navy blue is my favorite color, I turned to see what it was. And it was this brochure. And what really shocked me was it said, business as partners in development, creating wealth for countries, companies, and communities. The Prince of Wales Business Leaders Forum in collaboration with the World Bank and the United Nations Development Program. I almost fainted. Prince Charles? What is Prince Charles doing? And yes, I wrote my book on Prince Charles, and I was absolutely shocked because, you know, I had about the same time I read this speech commending the Brundtland Commission on Sustainable Development, and then I saw where he had this organization, and so I started researching the Prince of Wales. It's now known as the Prince of Wales International Business Leaders Forum. And I started researching it. About that time, he turned 50, I think. And I bought every single one of his biographies. There was a complete blackout with regard to his activities as they pertained to the International Business Leaders Forum.
Yeah.
All with the exception of one book, which had that name only in a series of other titles. There was a complete blackout. Joe Average was not supposed to know what the Prince of Wales was doing. And in fact, in 1997, when I was at a meeting in Rio de Janeiro, it was a press briefing with the woman who was the president of the International Chamber of Commerce at the time, some yahoo from British Petroleum, and a gentleman who used to work for Sia Brown Boveri, who is the Secretary General of the World Business Council on Sustainable Development, Swedish fellow, his name escapes me at this moment. And there weren't that many people in the press briefing. And I asked a question about Prince Charles' organization. And you would have thought I threw a bomb. There was complete shock. both the woman from the International Chamber of Commerce and the guy from the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, both of them went red, purple red. And so anyway, I knew I had hit a hot button because I had raised a question about the Prince Charles. And so anyway, I thought, wow, I'm onto something. And so the Prince started, he put together in 1990, he called for a business meeting in Charleston, South Carolina, and he put together a group of 50 corporations. It's in my book, Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince. For those of you who are in the States, call 301-371-0541 or go to my website, womensgroup.org, just as it sounds. And
we'll make sure we'll put that information on the website after the interview as well, Joan, so people can get it from there as well.
And so I realized that, you know, Prince Charles was leading the way. I've interviewed Jane Nelson, who wrote the book, she's a brilliant woman, Rhodes Scholar. She's written all of his how-to books on how to set up public-private partnerships worldwide. And she's really been a major liaison working with multinational corporations all over the world to set up these public-private partnerships. It's absolutely unbelievable. You know, this has really been going on since 1990. It was made public at the UN in 1995, this idea of public-private partnership. And now the Prince has been to the United Nations several times. Kofi Annan was the new Secretary General several years ago, and he gave a major keynote speech in 99 at the World Economic Forum in which he called for the United Nations to become privatized, if you will, through corporations coming in and helping them achieve their goals. And it was very interesting because I started covering the World Economic Forum in 1998. And the first meeting that I covered, I thought, my goodness, this is like a United Nations mega conference except it's for CEOs. And that was my impression. And then little by little, as I've been there throughout the years, what I have come to understand is that it is the catalyst, the hotbed, the facilitator for corporations to become, quote unquote, world peacemakers, para presidents and or quasi presidents and prime ministers. And you know, you could just see, you know, these CEOs would be meeting various world leaders and you didn't know who was more thrilled. You know, the CEO to meet, you know, Bill Gates, or Bill Gates to meet, you know, the president of, you know.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting, the dynamic.
But when I take a look at this, and, you know, Tex Mars did some research. Well, he has a lot of things sent to him, as I mentioned to you earlier. And he mentioned that he got information, I believe, that the royal family of Britain was not the original royals of that country. Some hundreds, a couple hundred years ago or 150 years ago, a German group of usurpers kind of moved into the British throne, and their roots go back to Judaism. And you had an interesting correspondence with somebody that confirmed that for you, did you not?
Yes, I did. Somebody who I have a great deal of respect for confirmed to me in a privately written letter that Prince Charles is partly Jewish, and that if he were to ever make public the things he knew about the prince, he would probably be taken out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and see, what I'm seeing here is the United Nations is really it's one of the working arms of the group that runs everything. And you'll find, if you go to the top of the working ladder, the United Nations is their international liaison to every small country and medium-sized country. But you'll also notice that the larger countries ignore the edicts of the United Nations if it doesn't suit their purposes. In other words, they give credibility to the UN through participating in their actions when it suits them. But when it doesn't, they move right along. And what you find out is always the agenda is always pro-Zionism. And sadly, when I look at this, I have to understand that the United Nations was set up as an arm of this group, like not any different than they used Freemasonry. If you take a look at the history of Freemasonry, it was taken over. The Grand Orient Lodge was taken over in the 1810-20 period. It seems as though they use organizations, international and national, as ways of controlling their agenda. And it's a frightful thing. And one of the people that I've had on the show, Dennis Halliday, you know Dennis? You've probably seen him at the UN.
No, I do not.
Well, he's a friend. I've spoken to Dennis on many occasions, privately as well as on the radio. And Dennis, when he was working at the UN, discovered some of the things that he saw were not what he believed when he first became a member of the UN staff. And ultimately, as a result of it, he walked away from his job after 27 years, reaching the third highest position in the UN organization. And what he said was that what they did in Iraq on behalf of World Zionism is a crime against humanity. And they stood by watching murder after murder being taken place, starvation. But you also see the UN having the same MO in Rwanda. You see it in Darfur. You'll see it in Cambodia. If you go around the world, you see that whenever it had suited their purpose to ignore a horror, they always have, and that they've also put people in jail, such as Milosevic, fabricated information, had Del Ponte do the work. Mm-hmm. This guy was a national representative of a country that they treated like a war criminal. When you look behind the facts, the guy wasn't a war criminal. I mean, it's pretty horrible to think that a venerated organization in many people's eyes is actually doing the bidding for a group of world supremacists.
When I was writing my book, Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince, I was given, revelation. It just hit me like a ton of balloons, a ton of bricks, I mean, that the United Nations was controlled by the British royal family. I have yet to change my mind about that completely. When you take a look at the environmental organizations, when they were started, Prince Philip helped start the World Wildlife Fund. You have both Prince Philip and Prince Bernard starting different environmental groups. And so when you look at the whole environmental agenda, there are a couple points I want to make, so I'll make this one first. What I see is that the whole environmental agenda, the whole goal, is to bring us into global feudalism under the ruling elite, number one.
Yeah.
Number two, I have interviewed numerous groups, delegates, whoever, from different African countries, mostly African, all over the continent there, and many of them have told me that there is no way they can withdraw from the IMF or the World Bank. If they do, they will be given economic sanctions and they will be destroyed.
That's right.
I've talked to other countries who've told me that there's no way they can't go along with the agenda because they will be destroyed. And one person who was the best friend of a man who used to be the president of Ghana, I met with him when he was here in the United States. Somebody told me about him, and we were able to meet, and I was explaining public-private partnership to him and how he needed to tell his friend about it and what it would do. And I mean, this was like 10, 12 years ago. And he looked at me and he said, "Let me explain to you. In Africa, if we go along, we get to eat one more day." Okay? But let me just talk about some of the other research that I have on my website, womensgroup.org. I had interviewed, when I was in Cancun, there were three African countries that had given a press briefing. And anyway, I went up to them. I asked them a very pointed question, and none of them wanted to answer my question. And so I interviewed each one of them separately, and I asked each one of them the same questions, and I got the same response. Aren't you a member of the Commonwealth? Yes. Well, why don't you go to Britain for help? There's no help. Well, why don't you withdraw? And when I suggested withdrawing from the Commonwealth, all three of them independently looked at me with fear and terror in their faces. And they said, we can't. And then I said, then it's not a voluntary organization, is it?
Well, no, and see, when you take a look at history, and you've probably done research on the Boer War and the usurping of the Dutch colonies down in that part of the world, but it was done at the urgings of Oppenheimer and Rothschild, and in fact, the agent that went down and managed the entire Boer War, and then after the fact, there were concentration camps. They were the first known major concentration camps in the world. Was Oppenheimer, and he went right back to the Rothschild banking people. Now, my point to you is this. When you ask somebody who runs America, if they're well-informed, they'll tell you that that Zionism is in control. If you take a look at AIPAC, you take a look at our electoral system, if you take a look at our judges, our everything, if you ask who's running the British monarchy right now, it's the same business forces. It's the Oppenheimers, it's the Rothschilds, it's the Levies. It's the same group, a Goldsmith. And what happens is it's people behind these governments, because we think these governments are taking the action. It's the people behind these governments that are setting the agenda.
You know, that's very true. One of the things that I found in researching the international level, after I did this interview with these three guys, I came home and I said, you know, there's something very fishy here, that the Commonwealth is allowed to operate inside the United States. And so if people will go to my website, they'll read my paper on the power of the British Commonwealth over the world. And what I ended up doing was a complete history of all the countries that the British have overpowered and taken. And then I saw that the British, on the international level, using the Commonwealth, which is, and they also have to read a couple of my essays, one of them is called Tyranny in the Congress. The bottom line is that the Commonwealth was the organization where countries that have been given their parliamentary independence, meaning they can elect their own people to parliament, they can have their own head of state, but they all report to the Queen, but it looks like they have some independence. Okay. Countries that have their independence, how the Queen now controls them is they pledge allegiance through the Commonwealth, because the Queen is the head of the Commonwealth.
But she actually has to bow down to someone higher than her. That's my point. She's not the top of the food chain.
I understand your point, and I'm not saying I disagree with it in any way, but I'm explaining to you from a standpoint of where the votes are on the international level.
Yeah.
There are 54 countries in the Commonwealth. Throughout the 60s, 70s, and a couple in the 80s, a whole host of British territories or colonies were given, quote-unquote, parliamentary independence. And every time they were given parliamentary independence, surprise, surprise, they got a vote at the United Nations or a vote at the IMF or a vote at the World Trade when it came into being, etc. So that today, for example, you have at the United Nations, there are 54 Commonwealth countries. Well, they have the potential of outvoting the United States 54 times. At the IMF, it's 45. At the WTO, it's 46. At the World Bank, it's 44. At the Group of Eight, it's 2. At the Bank for International Settlements, it's 38. And it goes on and on ad nauseum. In other words, this is a very brilliant takeover of the world through the international system by giving the Commonwealth countries a pseudo form of independence that gave them a vote on the international level.
But I keep going back to this. You know, if you take a look at who runs the World Bank, it's always been in the hands of the same criminal group. That's not a British-run group, but it's in the hands. It was Wolfensohn, then it was Wolfowitz, and then if you go to the Fed, it's Bernanke, and then it was Greenspan, and if you go to the Bank of England, it's the same story. If you go to the European Central Bank, if you go to the World Bank, it's the same story there. And in other words, when you start looking around the world, if you go higher than the British money system, and they're not in charge of world money, you find out that they're beholden to a group even higher than them, and that is world finance. And
so you don't believe that British royal family is equal to world finance?
Nope. I got to tell you why. And what I've discovered is that a group of very powerful Jewish financiers in the world, both in New York, London, in the city of London, which the Queen doesn't control, by the way, that is an independent one square mile of territory that she has to request to go into, was turned over to these people years ago, and through that control, they control the British Empire. And through the control of the Federal Reserve, they control the American Empire. And through the control of the European Central Bank, and even now we've got our stooges in France here with Mr. Sarkozy and Mr. Trichet. And if you don't know what the guy, Jean-Claude Trichet, who's the head of this ECB.
I've talked to him.
Yeah, well, his name means cheater, if you want to know.
He looks like one.
Well, his name means he cheats. Trichet means to cheat. That's his name. I mean, the guy's... If you talk about what these people's allegiances go back to, you'll find out that both in military sense, in economic sense, and in social engineering sense, there is an authority above the American government, above the British government, and above the European Union. And it's there that these decisions are being made, and that's the connection that I've been making, and it's the reason why I'm so maligned on the Internet and so attacked on the Internet. It doesn't negate in any way your research, because your research brings this conspiracy's control system to a very clear point, and it's an important point, because when you take a look at how they've been able to do this through Freemasonry, through the UN, through the World Bank, through all of these different armatures that they've arranged and set up, the CFR in America, the Round Table in Britain, all of these different associations, what you begin to see is that they have their minions set up in organizational structure to do their bidding. Now, the planning side of this goes back to, well, your Agenda 21 is a very powerful document, and of course, what they're going to try to do is like a tick, like a parasite, they're going to leech off of every man, woman, and child on this globe. When you take a look at who first financed the big push into China, the first bank to be allowed a license into China to do financing was Lazard Frere out of Zurich. Lazard Frere is a Rothschild bank. My point being is that all of those companies that are huge factories building all this cheap junk for everybody, they owe their allegiance to the people who gave them the money. This is an astonishing situation here, because when we start dissecting all these armatures, these apertures of control, what we find out is that we are in a real cesspool of trouble here. And in order to understand the whole thing, you got to step back and see what they've been able to do. And your research is very clear. And when I link it with people like Dennis Halliday's work and with Hans von Sponeck, who was also a UN high UN official, and I've talked to these people at length, it all becomes very clear. And Mohammed Rafig knows somebody that told him United Nations is really one of the top players in all of this. It's one of their major policy arms of the world. And
The UN, is, you know, look, isn't this fabulous? Under the guise of peace, all the countries of the world come, quote unquote, to talk, to work out their differences. So this is a central, it's like a train station, okay? It's the train station of the whole world governmental system that has been set in place to control.
That's
and
right.
It's very interesting. When you go to the UN, and I'm sure your other people who've been at the UN will tell you, you have all these countries, and everybody wants to be important. And so everybody, you know, has to give their little speech. And so who's going to say something more innovative than the next person? And it really is all about pride. It becomes an ego thing as to who is, you know, who's the cool guy, really, or gal, or whoever. And these people are all minions. And it's like they have gladly sold their soul to have a voice in world politics.
Well, you know what you're doing, Joan, is so important, because I'll tell you something. The leg of research that you've provided gives everybody a look inside the future agendas that are being set in place throughout the third world more than any other place, because in order for the governments of the Western world, under their control, to continue to rape the third world, the United Nations becomes an extraordinarily important tool for them. If you see what they've done in Sudan, in Chad, they're going to do it in Eritrea very soon, and Ethiopia, you can't believe what they did in Iraq. During the Food for program there in the 1990s, the United Nations stood by and watched mass numbers of people murdered through starvation and poisoning, and did absolutely nothing to stop it. They did nothing in Rwanda. They did nothing against the Janjaweed in Sudan. They've done nothing in Central America and with dictator after dictator. It's astonishing that these people can get away with this kind of fraud in the eyes of the world, of the public, and get all these, Angelina Jolie running around, and you want to vomit when you see this, when you know the truth. It's just horrible. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering where we go with this, except to keep telling the world what we know.
Well, it's called truth. When people ask me, what do? I tell them I'm a truth seeker. I'm a seeker of truth. And, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And it's very interesting in studying about Jesus. In John 1:1, it says, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, the Word was God, and then in the 14th verse it tells us the Word became flesh. Well, Word refers to Jesus and who he was. When you boil everything in life, everything in the world down to one action, it's Word. What happens with your words? And so, are your words speaking life, or are they speaking death and damnation? And these people are using deceit, deception, and distortion through their words to do exactly what Satan did in the Garden of Eden with Eve. I mean, there is nothing new under the sun. It is our turn, our time, to understand the truth about history. And what do? We do what we need to do, and that is speak truth with our words.
Well, I know you hadn't been to my research page in a while, and I know that you were a little surprised by the amount of movement we've had there. I mean, the effort has been nonstop for the last 3 years. We've never stopped. We're a research organization, the French Connection. And if you take a look on the internet, we are so maligned, Joan. People are just. And when you find out that the disinformation level on the internet is so huge, it's unbelievable. And it's no surprise, because look at the American government spent $3 billion on false news. Now, imagine what 3,000 million will buy you in false news. That's just the government. How about these organizations like APEC? How about the United Jewish Congress? How about all of the British MI6 money spent, the French? It's probably in the tens of billions sending out nonsense all over the world. Think about that. How many liars can you buy for that kind of money?
Well, what I have seen in the quote-unquote right wing, or whatever you want to call us, who understand a little bit more than the average person, is I have seen a lot of fear. And there are people who believe everything they hear on TV or everything on radio or the newspapers. And I have people call me, and they are just filled with fright. We are not to operate in fear. We are to operate in faith. We're to operate in truth and in reason. And that's not possible, because people don't have enough information to become knowledgeable, so they're not always operating in fear and adding to all the euphoria of what is and what isn't. Now,
mm-hmm.
I got to ask you a question before we go on, because I know our time's getting away.
Yeah.
You talk about the international bankers. Well,
yeah.
how can you say the British royal family has no part in international banking when King William was brought over specifically to England to replace King Charles II so that they could bring in international banking to England and set up the Bank of England, and he was one of the largest investors at with 10,000 pounds back then.
Well, my point would be to you, to and because of their Jewish roots, I would say that they are players in this large conspiracy, but they don't tie themselves to the British. They're not beholden to anything British. Britain is a vehicle for their actions. No different than the actions of George Bush on behalf of these criminals. George Bush takes his marching orders from on high, and on high is brought to him by Kissinger and by Schultz and by others. He's basically a puppet, as are most of heads of state. When you finally get back to it, if you look at who really has controlled world finance, even going back as Oliver Cromwell, when the money was given by Rothschild. When you see what the Jacobins were financed by Rothschild money, if you want to read Elizabeth Billings, she'll tell you about how that was done, and Nesta Webster will also discuss it with you. The facts are is that there is a cabal, a group, a virulent human group that has worked above its ultra-national, international in its scope.
Hello?
It doesn't have a border. It's in Sweden, it's in France, it's in Salonika, Greece, it's in the Caliphate's old regime of now it's when they took over Turkey. The point is that when you take a look at things like Balfour and Rothschild having that letter sent to him about the establishment of Palestine, when you see that Rothschild gives between 10,000 and 20,000 dollars per every immigrant to the Holy Land, when you talk about the fomenting of war between Christendom and Islam, all of these events internationally have been fostered and fomented by the same criminal group, and they use Britain as a means to an end. They don't necessarily come from Britain's hierarchy. They have infiltrated it like a host and a parasite, and that's exactly what's happened in America. It's exactly what happened in Russia during the last 100 years. They sent 4,000 Jews over there with $20 million and a shipload of weapons, and that 4,000 people took over that country and led it for 75 years. And when they were done with it, all of the resources of that nation were given over to the Abramowitzes and all of the different oligarchs that came out of it. They stole the place blind. It's the same situation, and it's not a single nation. It is an every nation. And that's one of the reasons why it's so hard for people to understand, because it's the biggest conspiracies people have trouble believing. And this
so
one actually...
You, in your opinion, when was it complete?
Completed? What do you mean?
Well, it's been coming for a while. It's been building. It's been maturing, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
When, in your opinion, was the world in a place where we could never go back?
I don't think we're at that place. I think what's happening now, because this group has always lived off of their ability to deceive. And something happened that they didn't expect, and that is the internet. And I'm going to give you see, they've got a monopoly on the world. They've had a monopoly on the world for tens of decades. They've been actually tightening that control as time has gone forward. But in 1990, when the internet was introduced, and it began as a rather benign technology, but what it's developed into is one that has crushed their monopoly. And I'll tell you how that works. If you know anything about monopolies, the only way you can defeat a monopoly is with a technology. Once a monopoly is ensconced, it is a permanent cash cow for the owners. The only way a monopoly can be displaced is by a technology that allows it to become obsolete. Now, the deception angle of this whole group, they've been required to deceive the world in order to stay in control. That deception, that veil of deception, is now becoming difficult to keep. And as it becomes clearer to the world who's been doing this to them, they're in big trouble because they simply don't have the numbers to control us all. Now, they may be able to take me out, or they may be able to take 10 of me's out, but Pandora's box of the truth is open. And little by slowly, the entire story is going to be told. And I think their days are numbered. And so, frankly, I think we've got a lot of pain between now and that time, but ultimately, they can't stop the flow of history. They've lost this battle already. And it's going to take us probably decades or maybe even beyond my lifetime and my children's to finally have a final battle with this, but they can't put the genie back in the bottle. And the technology of the Internet has sunk them. And how that is happening now is the truth about all this is growing exponentially every day. All you need to do is this. Joan, I don't never told you this statistic. When I started fighting this fight, if you type Zionism into a Google search, you got 1,700 examples on Google for Zionism. If you do it today, you've got 7 million and growing.
Wow.
The cat is out of the bag, and they can't put the genie back in. And as people find out who was behind the Boer War and who's running America's government through AIPAC and through child pornography and through sex trips to Thailand and using extortion and blackmail to get votes in Congress, and how George Bush has been put into place because he's an imbecile homosexual who can't wipe his own fanny. And you start looking at the people around these people, and their deception is crumbling. And even the people who are on the Internet lying for them are losing credibility, because unless they sign on to the facts about Zionism, they look like fools. Because as Elizabeth Dilling's story is told, and as Nesta Webster's is told, and Henry Ford's is told, and your friend Mr. Coleman's is told, and it goes on and on and infinitum, these people are looking more and more in trouble to me. Now, far be it from me to be at the final day of this fight, but because I don't think that I'm going to be gifted with that event. But certainly my children or their children will be. This is a done deal. I believe that.
Well, it's a done deal because God said it's a done deal. I mean, you know, this truly is a spiritual battle. It's really about good versus evil. That's exactly what it's about. It's about truth versus lies. And that goes back to the Garden of Eden. You know, this is a spiritual battle.
Well, I don't sign on to dogma. And it's not because I don't believe you have a right to. I certainly believe that everybody has a different way of expressing their belief system, and I respect that. Personally, I just believe that I'm a guy who doesn't want anybody telling me how to live my life. I've only got one of them. And the fact is that you don't get to have a second chance at this life. You get it and you go. Now, of course, if you believe in a life after, then fine, you're going to go to a better place. That's a belief system. What I do know is that if these people win their hand at this game, we're not going to have any freedoms. My right to speak freely is going to be abridged. And my right to associate freely is going to be eliminated. And that is an unacceptable state of affairs for this man. And I tell you this right now, faith gives people the ability to keep fighting. And for that reason, I believe faith is an important element to this whole thing. Spirituality also is, because that's where we get our moral code. Even though we sometimes break that code in our daily lives because we make mistakes, ultimately, Joan, you and I both know that our morality comes from a spiritual place within ourselves. And unless and until we all start wrapping our brain around that simple fact, we're going to continue to allow this obnoxious sickness to be descended on us. Look at what they do with tattooing and pinning through your head. And they're putting pornography on mainstream television now. They're showing it's the most vulgar sickness I have ever known. And it's getting worse. Now, that's because people are giving over their decision-making to a television set, or they're being dumbed down by chemicals and drugs and every other stupid thing you can possibly imagine. And I got to tell you, the fight is raging. But they're, you know, you got to be honest. The people are waking up, Joan. You see it in your daily life.
Yes. Well, you know, truth does win. It does win.
Yep.
Truth will win.
Yep. Well, so, you know I'm proud to have had you on this program, because the work that you've done is an important pillar to all of this research. And I have to say the United Nations, and I would love to keep abreast of your research, because I know that this Agenda 21, and I know this sustainable development thing is a real problem, and it has to be watched very closely. Many other items that we talk about here, about the money system being imploded and having going to a system where they have complete world control over buying and selling. We know that's coming. The dollar's tanking. Things are going south. There is an implosion of all different currencies. Fiat currencies have been printed until they're worthless. And so many elements to this conspiracy. But you know something? There are a lot of good people fighting this fight with us. And I feel proud to have you do your part. I really do. You've been working hard at it.
Yeah. Well, we all have different parts of the garden that we're tilling, and this is my part of the garden. It's part of the big garden. And,
yeah.
You know, just like some of the people you've mentioned that I'm not familiar with, you know, God has a way of bringing us all together in a major fabric. And, you know, your radio show is important because we only have so many ways to get truth out. All the newspapers, the radios, the televisions, all the mass media is controlled. And so we, the people, have very few ways to speak truth and to share what we know and what we've seen, because what we're hearing is not truth.
You're absolutely right. I want you to give your information one more time to the listeners so that maybe if the people want to look deeper into some of the information you've got on your website or purchase your book or any of those things, please do that. And we're going to give the information once again on the website. But why don't you go ahead.
The phone number for the women's group is 301-371-0541. It's womensgroup.org, womensgroup, womensgroup.org.
Now, a last question before we go. What did you think of Mohammed Rafik's take on finances?
Well, I think I told you I sent you a transcript. I mean, that took a couple hours.
Yeah.
Because I was so enwrapped in what he had to say. I mean,
yeah.
He has a different perspective. It's a couple rings above mine because, again, we all are in different parts of the garden.
Yeah.
And,
go ahead.
It's just really amazing. From my viewpoint, he saw what he saw. And from my viewpoint, I saw the need for a global, regulator. Financial regulator, something we don't have yet, which could possibly be the Financial Stability Forum, which comes through the Bank for International Settlements, in which all the G7 countries, their national regulators, plus their central bank, plus their treasury ministers, all participate.
Well, the Bank of International Settlement is set up by the Rothschilds to be the banker of the world. That is an owned and operated organ of the Rothschild fortune.
Well, I've been there quite a few times.
Mm.
I've been
inside.
I've had a tour. I've been at their meetings, their press briefings.
Mm. Well, they've got actually a couple of offices. They're in the Geneva office, yes? Was it Zurich or Geneva?
No, Basel, Switzerland.
Okay.
The Bank for International Settlements is in Basel. They now have offices. They just opened one in China. They have one in Mexico, and they have a couple others they've opened.
Well, that group, we'll dig up. We'll keep listening to the French Connection. I'll have some of these things talked about with Mohammed next time he's on, and you can check his research and see if it doesn't square with what you know. Okay.
All right. Great.
Thanks, Joan, for being on today. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Joan Vion. The women's group, she's given you her information. You can find more of her information on the French Connection. I hope what we've done today has opened some eyes about this United Nations story and some other things as well. But we don't have time to go into every single fact that we could have possibly talked about with Joan. But, again, this is an ever-increasing pool of information that we're digging through. And I want you to urge all of you, if you've got information that can extend this story for us, please send it in, and I will look it over and see if it can't help add a little bit more weight to our argument. Till the next time, ladies and gentlemen, take care of your families, and please be well. Bye-bye now.
Stop this tittle-tattle and this foolish prattle. Come on, kill me, Joe. swing it, brother, swing. Deep rhythm captivates me. Hot rhythm stimulates me. Can't help but swing it, boy. Swing it, brother, swing.